Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, Jim and I are talking with Catherine Belton, the author of the fantastic new book, Putin's People, which provides an in-depth look at Putin's Russia, and really the Russian system and the people who run it and the way things work. I think it's a fantastic book for people. If you haven't read it and you're interested in Russia and its relations with the United States and Europe, you really should give it a read. I'll give my honest disclaimer that I'm only on chapter 7. And I started the book a couple of weeks ago when we were on vacation. And as I was just telling Catherine and Jim, I took a lot of flack from my family for picking this book as my summer beach reading. But it's been totally worth it.
I have to say too, I was just, we were talking before we went on the air, and I'm working my way through the John Bolton book, but I think based on our conversation just over the past 30 minutes, I think I'm ready to throw John Bolton out the window and start immediately on this book. And I say that because what's interesting, not only for Russia watchers like Andrea, who spent a good part of her career as a Russia watcher, for me, I've been more of a Europe and NATO and this type of thing. And I think this book is going to provide me a lot of geopolitical answers to questions that I've had about how did we get here in terms of our relationship, particularly if you were involved in the early 90s and things looked like we were trending in a good direction, things just went to crap. And so how did that happen? What was going on, particularly in Moscow, that led us to where we are today? So I'm anxious to read this book too. I'm very happy that you're with us.
Yeah, thank you both for having me on. I'm really glad of the opportunity to chat about all this with you. And yes, I did try to sort of frame the book about sort of trying to explain how we got to this juncture and standpoint in relations between Russia and the West. It was really my aim to describe how we got here.
Yeah, I think the book is so, I mean, it provides so much insight and it's so illuminating for understanding Russia today. So having that backstory, understanding the mindset of the people in the Kremlin, the people around Putin, kind of understanding the way that they think and the way that they engage with the outside world. I think this book just provides such an excellent account for exactly what Jim said, how we got to where we are today, and I think kind of where things are likely to continue to go in the future. Before we dive in, we're going to have a million questions for Catherine, but just by way of background, not only is Catherine the author of Putin's People, but she's also an investigative journalist with years of experience reporting on Russia and the Kremlin. She served as the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times from 2007 to 2013, and she is now an investigative reporter for Reuters. So again, welcome, and maybe we can just continue with this line of discussion, and maybe just to hear you summarize or just very briefly describe Putin's Russia. I mean, how do you describe the political system that he created?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as I was examining sort of how he worked and how his men were essentially operating to take over strategic chunks of the economy, and as it became clear that they were also diverting cash flows to shore up their own power and then begin to project Russia's power abroad, that they were trying to reassert Russia's role on the global stage, as I began to look at it, it became sort of clear that he'd been appointing kind of loyal custodians in charge of various sectors of the economy, that he'd have a point man for oil and a point man maybe for metals, and they were all kind of essentially acting as arms of the Kremlin, not necessarily as independent entities in their own right. So it became a process of looking at how Putin operates through kind of very much a kind of a KGB frame of operating, that all his sort of instincts and reflexes are based in his sort of KGB past, and also the way that the KGB operated to sort of funnel assets in the past, in the 80s in particular, through these networks of loyal custodians who acted as their kind of strategic front people. And it's kind of a model that he's sought to replicate in Russia, and it became sort of a way of understanding understanding how he manages the economy and how, you know, the West has been used in the past to sort of viewing Putin's asset grab, the asset grab by his people, as just mainly an attempt to sort of take over cash flows for themselves, just to line their own pockets so they could live a life of luxury in palaces and have yachts and whatever. And yes, that is true to some degree, but there's only so many tens of billions of dollars you can spend on yourself. It became sort of an instrument to that they could use to essentially buy elections or officials at home, and then abroad, that they were sort of recreating sort of big slush funds and networks of allies that they could use to carry out operations for them. So I tried to view them through kind of Putin's own identity as a KGB officer.
One of the kind of issues in the book that has garnered a lot of discussion, I think, is the way that you tell the story about Putin's pathway to the Kremlin. You know, there had been some, I mean, including in the Moscow establishment, who would tell a story about how Putin kind of lucked into the position. But the way that you tell the story is far more intentional, that there were these Siloviki, the KGB networks that through the end of communism kind of went underground, but were still very much in place, and that worked to get one of their men back into the Kremlin so that they could control their positions of power, access to wealth, and other things. So maybe can you tell us a little bit about Putin's pathway to the Kremlin? How do you describe that process? And really, like, how would you push back against that narrative that it was kind of accidental or lucky that Putin was in the place that he was when he was, versus this kind of much more concerted push to get a KGB man back in the Kremlin?
You know, I think it's a mixture, it's a combination of both. Of course, the fact that Putin became president, it's partly down to luck, and it's partly through kind of the maneuverings of sort of oligarchs around him who believed that he was their protege, who believed that they could control him, and that they were essentially putting a person in power who was their man. But it's also a story very much about sort of how Putin, I think, has been sort of greatly underestimated. He is a chameleon. He's very good at sort of reflecting back at people what they want to see, and that's part of how of the art of how he got to where he is today. And there's no doubt at all that he wouldn't have been able to sort of make the leap to the presidency if he didn't have a support group, if he didn't have a network of support among the security services. It just wouldn't have happened. And so we see, I began my research for the book trying to look at sort of what exactly happened at the Soviet fall. I believe that there was a great deal that we had been overlooked during the communist collapse, because obviously in the tumult of the time, like, so much was happening and the pace of change was so fast that of course some events got overlooked. But if you go back to sort of the early 90s and sort of after the failed coup of 91, when Yeltsin came to power and the Communist Party was banned, back then there were Russian prosecutors who'd been charged by Yeltsin to investigate sort of what happened to the Communist Party's wealth at the Soviet fall, because there were these bank accounts that the Communist Party should have had which had disappeared, and there'd been also huge amounts of raw materials which had been spirited out of the country. And it became sort of a process of digging back through the Russian prosecutor's own investigations and some of the archives that appeared in the Russian press at the time. And it was clear that there had been sort of networks of foreign intelligence operatives working for the KGB who would advise the Communist Party that you should start kind of preparing for a transition to the market, that you should begin to move assets. We'll create an invisible economy for you and we'll help you survive this transition to the market. But essentially, the Communist Party was spent as a political force after the botched hardline coup, but the KGB were essentially in charge of these assets when it all came crashing around the communist regime. And I also lucked out with sort of one interview that I had with a former chairman of Kroll, who'd also been hired by the Yeltsin government to investigate what happened to the Communist Party funds. And he told me, look, Kroll was bought in under a $4 million contract, essentially as a fig leaf. They didn't give us access to any information the Russian prosecutors had. They didn't really want us to do anything. They just wanted to present to the world that they were looking, that they were really looking for the Communist Party's wealth. But in fact, they didn't want to know, and that he believed, from what he was able to glean through their own independent investigations, that yes, the foreign intelligence arm of the KGB had been very active in sort of siphoning a lot of wealth in the final years before the Soviet collapse through kind of raw materials deals, through front companies and banks in Europe, in which they'd sell kind of low-priced Soviet commodity wealth and resell it on the world stage at a much higher world price and get to keep the profits. And he believes that vast amounts were siphoned that way, also through trading companies such as Mark Rich. And he believed that sort of course, yes, a lot of this wealth was stolen, but he also believed at the end of the day it was these foreign intelligence operatives of the KGB who'd been sort of essentially holding the keys to the wealth, and that they were still trying to preserve their own networks. I mean, of course, it was the foreign intelligence arm of the KGB who could also, they traveled widely in the 80s. They could see that the Soviet economy, the planned economy, was never going to be competitive to the West. They were the ones who sort of began stoking the drive for some reforms. They began stoking the move to the market, and they ran many of the institutions where the first perestroika reforms were drafted. So they were kind of at the vanguard of these moves, and they were preparing. I'm not saying that the whole thing, the whole kind of communist collapse, was a plot by the KGB, but they did see that continuing under the planned economy just wasn't feasible anymore, that the ideology of communism was really failing sort of Russia or the Soviet Union as an empire, and they had to move, and they were trying to preserve what they could along the way. And I think sort of probably after the communist collapse, part of them had sort of moved to Yeltsin, because they could see that Gorbachev's, the Soviet leader's attempts at reform were going to be too slow, that Gorbachev wanted to keep socialism as the main guiding force of the government. And as one of them put it to me, they could see that Gorbachev's reforms were going to be as effective as fried snowballs. It wasn't going to get them to where they needed to go. So one by one, including the former head of the KGB, Viktor Chebrikov, they'd moved to back Yeltsin. And that may be one of the reasons why the hardline coup against sort of the hardline coup failed, and why Yeltsin was able to rise to come to power, because essentially the KGB never made any moves to arrest Yeltsin. And they sort of let these protests continue. So you do see sort of factions. The KGB was not monolithic, but there were factions who were supportive of Yeltsin. They wanted to move to the market, and they were trying to preserve their networks. And I think probably they were divided too about how they wanted to sort of handle the West. Did they want to preserve their networks to continue the fight against the West? Probably yes, some of them did. Others may have wanted a reprisal. But as the Yeltsin era went on, it was clear there was a hardcore faction of security men who were viewing with horror sort of what was going on with under Yeltsin, that he was telling the regions, for instance, to swallow as much freedom as you can. They believed that this was going to lead now to the breakup of Russia itself. They were watching in horror as the oligarchs, these young business tycoons that they'd also helped create in the perestroika reforms, they were watching in horror as these tycoons were becoming uber powerful, gaining access to Yeltsin government accounts, and then using those funds to start taking over prime industrial assets and becoming more and more powerful to such a degree they were oligarchs dictating their will to the Yeltsin government. And then and they also believed that this could lead to the further breakup. They'd been siphoning money into the West, and that essentially they feared that Russia could become sort of either an appendage of the West, that the oligarchs were in somehow thrall to the West because all their bank accounts were in the West. And, you know, it was a real, I think there was definitely a hard core of security men who wanted, who believed it was their mission to save Russia. And I also had a lucky break very early on in the reporting when I met a former KGB operative who'd worked with Putin in the early 90s in St. Petersburg on various barter schemes, which, by the way, he also demonstrated were a way to keep funding sort of networks that they sort of used in the past in Soviet times for influence operations and so on. And he also basically told of this plot that they had been biding their time. They'd been waiting in the wings. They were sort of they'd gotten hold of compromising information on Yeltsin and his family. They knew this former KGB operative had been working at a Swiss bank, which sort of held the Yeltsin family credit card accounts, and he'd been sitting on this and kind of waiting for the moment to use them because it was illegal for any state official to hold foreign bank accounts, and the credit cards were equivalent to foreign bank accounts, and they've been given to the Yeltsin family to use by a Swiss construction firm which had landed a multi-billion dollar contract to reconstruct the Kremlin. So it looked like they were kickbacks, and the Yeltsin family had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on these cards, and the plan was to hold up evidence of this in the parliament, which was dominated by the communists then, and just say, look, Yeltsin is a thief. The first plan was for the former spy master, the foreign intelligence chief, Yevgeny Primakov, to use this as an opportunity to take back power. He'd already become prime minister. But Primakov, for whatever reason, didn't leap at this, and Yeltsin was able to fight back. But all the time you had Putin, who'd been rising very quietly through the ranks of the Kremlin. And again, my argument would be that he would never have been able to sort of rise so rapidly through the ranks of the Kremlin had he not had serious backing in the security services. And I mean, he went in as deputy chief of the Kremlin property department in 96. By 97, he was deputy chief of staff. By 98, he was first deputy head of the Kremlin, and that put him in close contact with Yeltsin for as many as 1.5 months before he was made head of the Federal Security Service, the successor agency to the KGB. And again, there's still a lot we don't know about how he was able to make that transition, because essentially he was meant to be a civilian, but somehow the KGB, the FSB generals didn't mutiny, and he was allowed to kind of essentially kind of run the Federal Security Service.
Wow.
Sorry, yeah, that's a lot.
That is just an amazing, and I know Andrea's got a question, but just to say, it sounds like something that the Trump development corporation that he had been working for so many years before getting into politics would have fit right into that, whether like the Swiss construction firm giving credit cards and all this. It just sounds like the kind of atmosphere that would have suited very well those who worked with Trump in those years. All that we've read and heard over the past couple of years, it just sounds like the kind of environment that Trump would have flourished in.
Well, we can get to that, Jim, because she has a chapter at the end on relations between Russia and Trump. So we can get to some of those ties and some of what she was able to uncover, but maybe we can save that little bit till the end. I mean, I could ask you 1,000 questions about the story that you just told, but I think one is that's so interesting is kind of Putin's chameleonic nature. I mean, you talk through the book about, you know, during his time in Dresden, that perhaps he was involved in much more nefarious actions, terrorist-related actions, perhaps. You talk about his time in St. Petersburg, where he was certainly involved with all of the shady dealings around the port, ties with organized crime. It comes later, obviously, after he's in power, but with the apartment bombings and whether or not the Russian government actually played a role in those to try to consolidate support for Putin. So there's a pretty clear picture about who Putin is. But yet he was able to kind of dupe the Yeltsin family, who you describe kind of saw him as someone who would be equipped to carry on this legacy towards democracy in Russia. And so I guess my question, I mean, really is, to what extent do you think Putin, when he assumes the presidency in 2000, intended to take things in the direction that he did, that he intended to make Russia the authoritarian system that we see today? Or to what extent is this more like a story of the appetite that grows with the eating? You know, you also outline in the book, and I think things that we know from authoritarian regimes and stuff that I've done in my research talks about authoritarianization and the process that governments go through, including cracking down on the media, which Putin did with Gunitsky and a whole bunch of others, brought the media to toe. What's the saying, to heal. he reined in the governors. I mean, all of the steps that you see in other authoritarian regimes, you also see in the Putin regime. But to what extent do you think he came in expecting to take Russia in a more authoritarian direction? Or do you think that this just kind of evolved over time? And as he saw what he was able to get away with, he continued to push for more?
Yeah, I think it did evolve over time. I mean, obviously, yes, the Yeltsin family saw what it wanted in Putin, that he was sort of this everyman, because he was very little known. People didn't know very much about him. And I think the Yeltsin family was sort of trying to latch on to whatever they could, because as we discussed, they were under threat of investigation over the credit cards. They needed somebody from the security services to take over. So, I mean, but they believed that Putin was the one who was liberal. He was young. He seemed progressive. He paid lip service to their ideals. He basically told them what they wanted to hear, and he did a very good job of doing so. And they were sort of, kind of, in some ways, kind of comforted by his background in St. Petersburg, where he'd served as a deputy to the very democratic seeming mayor, Anatoly Sobchak, and that they believed that sort of having such a mentor to whom Putin was incredibly loyal was a key sign that he would be one loyal to them, and that he'd sort of continue to kind of further those ideals of democracy. And I guess sort of, but Putin did speak about sort of liberal reforms. He did speak about democracy, but always with a kind of a statist tinge to it. You could hear it in his sort of first inauguration speech, when sort of Yeltsin was saying we have to kind of protect the freedom, our hard-won freedoms. Putin at the same time was saying we also have to honor and value all stages of Russia's history, no matter who was in charge, because that's what made us great, whether it be Stalin or Ivan the Terrible and so on. So, you know, he was always sort of speaking about restoring Russia's greatness, and indeed, that chimed very well with the population then. And of course, they were tired of all the chaos and the collapses and the financial kind of crises of the Yeltsin years. So he was, you know, everyone was looking for someone to bring stability to the country, and Putin appeared to be offering stability, a stronger state, but he was also pressing ahead initially in his first years with these liberal reforms. And I think, I was told by one oligarch who then sort of was a business partner of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, that they could see the warning signs. They could see his attack on the media tycoons and sort of how ruthless he and his security men had been in sort of essentially using the threat of jail sentences to take over TV stations and the use of force, essentially. But they also said, you know, but the economy was doing so well, oil prices were rising, and you know, we just had our rose-colored glasses on. We didn't really want to see what was happening. But it was an evolutionary process, because obviously the first big step that Putin took was to take on Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who then was Russia's richest man. He owned the biggest oil major of the time. But Khodorkovsky also happened to be trying to sell control of his oil major to the US. He looked like he might pose a political challenge to Putin. At some point, he was funding opposition parties, and indeed, quite openly hinting he might run for the presidency himself in 2008. And of course, all of this was unpalatable for a group of security service men who did have their kind of reflexes sort of buried in the Cold War. They couldn't contemplate sort of the idea that Russia's biggest oil major would be sold, sort of at least a controlling stake to the West, and they couldn't contemplate this idea of a guy who had all these billions who was planning to use them against their own policies. So they took him down, and they managed to do so in a way that was kind of described to me as death by a thousand cuts. They didn't sort of immediately kind of gobble up his oil company in one go, but step by step they began imposing more and more back tax charges in a way that they managed to keep the Western investor community on board and sort of end up with Western investors lining up to take part in the Kremlin asset grab. So they didn't sort of do so kind of drastically that they completely ruined their own investment climate. They managed to sort of keep Western banks and other Western energy majors on board, and indeed everyone ended up wanting to be a partner with the Kremlin, because the Kremlin had essentially taken over the court system, so you knew it was going to be a sure bet to be partnering with them. So, you know, it became, as you say, it sort of appetite grows with eating, because they were able to get away with the takeover of the country's biggest oil giant. And once they'd done that, everyone else was fair game. And the other sort of oligarchs who'd been independent were cowed, and they knew that they had to toe the Kremlin line. Otherwise, they would face the same possible fate as Khodorkovsky, because all these laws could be applied exactly how Putin's men wanted to. So, you know, it's a gradual process, but if you're trying to rule a country like Russia and you have your kind of mindset ingrained in these kind of operations of control, then, you know, it's just, I think that's the only way they knew how to operate, essentially.
I know Jim has a question, but I mean, it just is such a warning call, though, obviously Russia was a very young, fragile democracy. It wasn't anything like the more established democracies in the West, but these things happen gradually, slowly over time. It's like the frog in a boiling pot of water. Putin, exactly. Like other leaders, Orbán's and Erdogan's, and I mean, I say in our own country too, they do things slowly, gradually, incrementally. It allows people, political observers, certainly in the West, we were able to explain away a lot of the things that Putin was doing because the economy was doing well. There was a belief that he was going to clean things up. But it is a great warning that these things happen slowly, gradually, incrementally, without eliciting strong backlash, and you see the direction that it can take things. So it's such a warning. I mean, the story that you tell about how Putin consolidated control is a warning for other democracies too, about how this can happen so slowly, but insidiously over time. But Jim, I know you've got a question.
No, Andrea, I think what you just said is just fabulous. You know, the lessons, as I listen to you speak, the parallels to what we're in today here in the United States is so striking. Particularly the importance of the media, the importance of the ability to push back, the importance of judges. I mean, it's just, oh my goodness. I just it's been a tremendous past couple of minutes. And Andrea, I think you really summed it up really well. Just a real quick question. You know, you mentioned rose-colored glasses a minute ago about how Putin was looked on in those early days. Well, you know, certainly it seems to me here in Washington, if we take it back to those days, 1990, 91, 92, 93, Washington, D.C., Republicans and Democrats, as the administrations changed, we were thrilled with the end of the Cold War, hopeful about, you know, new relations with Russia, helping Russia become a democracy and a market economy and, you know, my member of NATO. I mean, you know, all of that was being discussed, and lots of money going in. I remember our ambassador in Moscow said, if I had $100,000 to invest, I'd invest it here in Russia. There's so much blah, blah. You know, it just went on and on. A lot of rose-colored glasses, because hearing what you were just saying, the idea, number one, I don't know how much we knew about that during those days in terms of how Moscow and how Russia was grappling with this transition. You got the oligarchs, you had a lot of personal fortunes. The idea that the U.S. and the West could parachute into the middle of this chaos there, if you will, as they try to protect their power in Moscow and their money in Moscow, et cetera. The idea that we could parachute into that and bring about a market economy and bring about a democracy. How naive were we? Again, we probably didn't understand it either. And again, it wasn't as well organized as it later became. But still, as I look back on that, I think we were extraordinarily naive. We were wearing rose-colored glasses too. And this was doomed for failure. Would you say that's right?
Yes, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that the kind of the closer I looked at sort of the even the Yeltsin era government in the early 90s, even though you had these sort of young reformers who were lauded by the West for bringing the market to Russia, like Yegor Gaidar, who was Yeltsin's first prime minister, they were still very much in the minority. You still had sort of the head of the central bank was this wily Soviet era banker who'd sort of worked in the foreign banking system for the Soviet state, essentially funding operations for Communist Party influence abroad. He was a covert ops man, essentially. And, you know, and even Yegor Gaidar, when I began sort of looking at his operations, even though he was making all these sort of very radical reforms to bring the market to Russia, he was still signing off on schemes to keep intelligence networks running. One of the most telling episodes was really, as long ago as 1992, when the entire Russian budget was $162 million. That's all the money they had to pay teachers, pensioners, and other state workers, and so on. But Gaidar still signed off on a scheme to barter oil from Russia for sugar from Cuba that was worth $200 million. And it was a scheme that was cooked up to make sure that Russia could keep its Lord's listening station running in Cuba. It was the main base to listen on the US. So right. he was signing off a scheme that was worth more than the entire Russian budget at that time. And that's sort of how important that the importance that they attached to the security networks then was such that he was either forced to sign off on it or he wanted to, that they were always somewhere in the background and they weren't ever really going to be sort of just handing over everything to the West, that the all that was left for Russia to do was to integrate with the West. And I really do believe that that's what the West perhaps naively thought, that Russia would only aim to integrate with the West and join this Western global-led order. And indeed, sort of Putin himself, when he came to power, also paid lip service to these ideals. But I'm not sure whether he fully intended this or whether after he came to power, when NATO continued to expand eastwards, whether perhaps he became disappointed in the West and he believed that the West was ignoring Russian interests. So, but I guess that's another question, and back to you on that.
Well, this might be a better question for Andrea, but I'd be interested to hear what she has to say. How much do you think we knew at the time of what was happening in the background in Moscow among the oligarchs, among the security services, among the old politicians, as that transition was happening between communism and going into whatever you would call Russia post-communism? How much do you think we knew? Probably the intelligence services knew in the West. How much the political structure, the American president, prime ministers, NATO, how much we knew? I mean, I guess we were trying to put it together as well, but do you think as we made political decisions in the 90s that we knew this was the atmosphere in Russia that we were dealing with, or we were still trying to put it together? Andrea, I bet you've got a view on that.
Yeah, I think so. I obviously wasn't there, and so these would just be kind of like more stories that are more passed down. But I mean, you just go back to the rose-colored glasses, and I still think, like Jim, the kind of euphoria and the excitement and the optimism that you explained that was happening on the policy side of things, I think was equally reflected perhaps in the intelligence side. And even, you know, I hear stories about debates inside the intelligence community about who Putin was and the direction that he wanted to take Russia. And there was a large contingent, even in the intelligence services, that saw Putin as a great reformer, who saw him, you know, moving things in a right direction, cleaning house, cleaning up these corrupt networks. There were people who still thought that Putin was moving Russia in a positive direction, in a more democratic direction. And I'm not exactly sure about when the shift in orientation took place, but it was, I mean, at least not until 2004 or later. I mean, in those earliest days, I still think that there was, I mean, I guess I'm talking about post-2000 with Putin. But there, I think that kind of optimism characterized a lot of what was happening. But Catherine, I don't know, as you were looking back, I mean, I know you were going back over record. So how, I mean, this was one of my questions for later, but I mean, were there things that you have learned, that you learned during your research that was surprising? Kind of as you look back over the historical record, I would assume that you had a fairly well-formed understanding of a lot of these trends and dynamics. Were there things that you uncovered in your research that you found surprising?
Yeah, I think, I mean, just again, this example that I just mentioned of how Guaidó was trying to divert money to kind of fund sort of intelligence operations and networks, even when the Russian budget was having barely any cash. The fact that these type of operations were continued to be funded, that was surprising, because yes, we have held up Guaidó to be this sort of great pro-Western state. But the fact was, there was not only the Lord's listening station, but Putin's former economic advisor, Andrei Ilyaronov, who was later on the board of some of Russia's state banks. When he was in that position, he was able to uncover some funds that had been shifted. I think it was $1 billion that had been shifted in the early 90s to bail out another Soviet foreign state bank in Paris, which was again central to these type of kind of intelligence networks and for funding kind of Russian operations abroad, that the cash had then been diverted as well in the early 90s. So that was surprising to me, to the degree that sort of security service operations continued to find ways to fund themselves. That what was surprising was the degree that they kind of remained a force to be reckoned with in the shadows in the 90s. And I think, of course, in that era, the West's attention was rightly captured by the rise of these sort of brash new tycoons, the oligarchs, who'd become sort of uber powerful. But in a way, they were sowing the seeds then for the revenge of the security services, because the security services had tried to keep tight hold of things like sort of export channels that used to be their purview when they were running the Soviet trade ministry, and they always tried to keep tight control over commodities exports. And then when the oligarchs sort of came out of nowhere and took over most of these strategic assets at a discount, I think the security services were plotting their revenge. And sort of in my reporting, I also came across one instance where some ex-KGB officers who had been close to Putin from the St. Petersburg days had missed out in a battle over an oil asset with Khodorkovsky in the later 90s. So that was again sort of sowing the seeds for revenge, for perhaps forming one of the reasons that why they wanted to go after him later when they came to power. So it was just the degree really to which the KGB had not as the West presumed sort of been a complete bust. Everyone was used to talking about how everyone had resigned and gone to work for commercial structures because they didn't have any money or influence anymore. But actually there were sort of elements and factions who remained intact, in particular the foreign intelligence arm, and they were trying to preserve what influence they could. And that was really the most surprising when I was working on it.
So I have two questions that kind of get that take your research and then help us understand the Russia that we see today. And one is about the extent to which you think Putin controls the political system. And I think sometimes in the Russia community, you can hear different views. One is that, I mean, this is a personalist regime. Clearly no man rules alone, but there is a small clique of Putin and a handful of people around him that are directing things inside Russia. Then I've heard some others argue that no, actually Putin is really a prisoner of this system, that you had this giant network, they got their man in the position of power, and he's actually quite beholden to these people. And even if he wanted to step down, he really couldn't. And so I wonder, just as you've researched this, how do you think about the way that decision-making works inside Russia, the way that the system works? Is this really about Putin and just a couple of folks around him? Or is he really kind of entrapped by this system and unable to leave because these people need Putin in order to maintain their access to power and resources?
I think it's an element of both. It is a small clique of people around him. It's Putin and his allies from the security service from St. Petersburg, who are now very much running the country. And I think in the beginning, he might have genuinely felt that he told the Yeltsin family, for instance, that he was only going to be president for a few years, maybe not even complete a first term. He'd tell them he was the hired manager, which again sort of burnished his credentials in their eyes, because they thought, yes, this means that we can control him. But as he became more and more entrenched in power, I believe the security service people around him, the KGB connected business allies, they are all were intent on trying to make sure that Putin remained in power, because again, as they acquired more and more assets in various nefarious ways, including the takeover of Khodorkovsky's oil major, which has now been judged in numerous international courts as being a politically motivated attack, they knew if Putin steps down, then essentially the equilibrium is disturbed. Perhaps some of the assets that they've acquired could be open to attack or could be taken from them. So I heard during the reporting that there were various instances when Putin himself wanted to step down, but the security men around him basically maneuvered to make sure that he wasn't able to do so. And I'm sure now, after 20 years in power, probably Putin himself, I'm sure he probably doesn't want to be kind of right in the thick of it and president for life. It's probably quite a stressful job, but on the other hand, he doesn't have much choice either, because we all know sort of the activities they've been up to in shoring up their power means that it's just very difficult for him to step down, and it makes it very precarious for any of his allies. And I think the way that he rules is to balance various clans and individuals against each other. So the minute he is removed as that kind of ultimate arbiter, the balance shifts, and it's too precarious, because there aren't any institutions in Russia that work, although rule is based entirely on personal understandings between this small clique of people running the country, which means there's no option for a succession.
So I have a related question, which is then, you know, what happens after Putin? I think you hear sometimes a lot, people tend to personalize the Russian system. You make it all about Putin. They see that Putin is the responsible for this more assertive, more aggressive foreign policy. And you could hear sometimes in policy circles, well, if we can just wait Putin out long enough, which although that now appears to be getting longer as he's able to extend term limits. But if you can just wait Putin out, that things will be better. And so I guess I wonder, based on what you know, how much truth is there to that? I would say probably very little, because as you've well described in the book, it's not just Putin, but his foreign policy priorities and preferences are shared by a large group of people around him, such that even without Putin, a lot of these kind of key pillars of Russian foreign policy remain unchanged. So I guess when I think about like what a post-Putin Russia, in my mind, it depends a lot on how Putin exits power. If it is a managed succession, then his foreign policy priorities can continue. Whereas if you were to see a more organic bottom-up protest that is able to topple the regime and see fresh faces sitting inside the Kremlin, that maybe then there would be chances for at least some deviation from what you see now. But, you know, how would you explain to a policymaker how much of this is about Putin and how much is this about the foreign policy priorities that are kind of baked into the Russian political system, the Russian citizens, and the political elite?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think at the moment, the current sort of very aggressive stance against the West and all these sort of nefarious activities to try and undermine institutions and use Russia's wealth as a means for buying off and corrupting kind of politicians and other institutions in the West, I think that's very much driven by Putin and the close-knit network of security men around him. This is Nikolai Patrushev, the former head of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, who's now the Security Council chief. I was told by one former very close Putin ally that he's the one who sort of really views capitalism as a means of getting even with the West as an economic weapon. Again, it's asymmetric because they're not able to compete directly with the West as a strong economy, but what they can do is divert cash flows to try and pick off politicians and fund extremist left and right groups in the West. And that's what they're doing. And I think that the fact that it was this sort of very ruthless clan of security service people who came to power along with Putin, that they came from St. Petersburg, they'd been operating hand in hand with organized crime in the early 90s, that they didn't have many qualms about doing that, that they were able to operate so aggressively, means that Russia has been run really by a very, very ruthless clan of security service officers for a long time. But also in my interviews, it's clear that there are other groups, whether they be security service connected or not, who are more aggressive and more willing to sort of enter into partnership with the West, and that they, some of them are very critical of the way that Putin and this particular group of security service officials are running the country. They sort of will shrug their shoulders and say, this is what happens when you have a bunch of KGB men running the country. They have no vision for developing the economy. All they know is how to run black ops, take cash, divvy it up between themselves and use it to shore up their own power and then undermine enemies abroad, and that there's nothing happening in Russia's own economy. So it's clear that there's a great deal of internal dissent as well within the elite. But unfortunately, as we've seen after the recent nationwide vote allowing Putin to remain in power for another a very long time till 2036, essentially we're seeing now a kind of a crackdown on opposition, that sort of there are groups being sort of hauled off to jail, but we are seeing the first outbreaks of protests as well in the Far East. So I think sort of Putin is now going to have to deal with this internal dissent, and we, you know, could go either way. We'll see how it plays out in Khabarovsk in the Far East, where tens of thousands of protesters have taken to the street against the firing of a local governor. And this is really quite unprecedented for Russia, that these protests have been now entering into their second week. It's a long time, and we yet to see how Putin's going to handle it. I think he's probably hoping they die out by themselves, but you know, I think clearly there are groups that the longer he remains in power, the longer the economy stagnates, who are really becoming dissatisfied, and so which does leave room for opportunity for perhaps seeing a different type of leadership who might not have such an aggressive stance towards the West, particularly after all the isolation and sanctions that have been imposed in recent years, which have taken a real toll on the economy.
Andrea mentioned earlier that you have a chapter in your book towards the end that talks about Donald Trump. Here on Brussels Sprouts, we try not to get too political, really. I mean, our mothership is nonpartisan, and this isn't meant to be a partisan political question, but it's just striking. A lot of what you've described for Russia and Putin and his operations to what we see around here too. So from your chapter that you've written, as you look today at the United States, as you looked at the United States back when you're writing your book, what do you see? What kind of parallels? I mean, you're in the UK, you're writing this from across the pond. As you cast your eyes our way, what do you see? What's striking to you?
And so, I mean, just after also the UK announced, you know, officially Russian meddling in the 2019 general election too. So, I mean, I think, Jim, great question, because there's so many parallels between what Russia is doing in terms of attacking Western democracies, using not only corrupt networks, but also exploiting the openness of our societies. And so I had a similar question.
And also the Trump relation, how Trump has organized his government, how he governs, and the potential relationships between Trump and his whole development and building empire before he became president, and its activities in Moscow. That's a huge question for both of us. But what do you think?
Yeah, this is what I really tried to hone in on the final chapter, because again, I had a stroke of luck with one contact who indeed had known Trump since the early 90s. This was a Moscow construction tycoon called Shelva Chigurinsky, who'd also happened to be friends with sort of Russia's foreign intelligence chief, Yevgeny Primakov. And Primakov had encouraged him to leave the Soviet Union in the late 80s. He'd been very actively involved in antique smuggling, and then he moved into construction even before the Soviet fall. And he had in fact been approached by two Atlantic City casino operators in the very late 80s who traveled to meet him in Yalta in the south of the Soviet Union, and had said that they'd heard of the fabled Communist Party wealth and thought perhaps Atlantic City casinos might be a great destination to hide some of the funds. Chigurinsky, of course, said that never happened because the US markets are too transparent. Of course, we'd never be able to funnel Communist Party wealth there. But shortly afterwards, he was introduced to Donald Trump, and so began a beautiful friendship, because Chigurinsky then continued to orbit Trump for most of the next two decades. He was in talks with Trump about building a Trump Tower in Moscow in the 2000s. And he was also very closely connected to Aras Agalarov, who we all know is a construction tycoon who ran the Miss Universe contest in Moscow in 2013. The infamous one which Trump attended. And he was also connected to Felix Sater, the guy who ran the Bayrock real estate company, who began working very intensively with Trump after 2001. So really the research actually found that there was a kind of a network of sort of Moscow tycoons, some with connections to Russian intelligence and some with connections to organized crime. We know from Felix Sater's own admissions that he had good contact in the Russian intelligence community. He's spoken of this himself. We know that this is a very loosely linked network of individuals who've really been surrounding Trump since the early 90s. And I believe that their relationship with him was probably one of convenience originally, that he did become a very convenient funnel through which to kind of send money from Russia, whether illicitly acquired or not, we knew that Trump didn't do much due diligence. We've heard that from one of his former Trump Organization executives. Then he was a very good known entity to them because he'd been traveling to the Soviet Union since 87. We know that he was wowed by the architecture, and as one close Putin ally put it to me, that he was also wowed by Slavic women, that he has a particular penchant for them. And so he became, the way that he operates, I think he's quite disruptive in his own nature, but that also certainly fitted a certain Russian agenda. And one former Soviet KGB officer said he believed that when Trump first visited Russia or Soviet Union, Moscow in 87, that he'd been recruited then. Of course, we have no way of telling whether that's true or not. And probably Trump, if he was recruited, perhaps has no idea that he was. But he certainly, when he returned to the US, what he did on his return was certainly music to the KGB's ears, because he printed several open letters in several major US newspapers calling for the US to tear up its alliances with the likes of Japan and Saudi Arabia, all of which were kind of post-Cold War alliances that the Soviets were very, very jealous of. I think they did kind of certainly value him for his ability to disrupt. But I guess at some point as well, he became a political opportunity for the Russian security services, but I guess that only happened later. I don't think anyone in their wildest dreams ever could believe that he could become a US president, but certainly as his campaign picked up momentum, he was already just a known entity who had been encircled by this same group of Moscow money men for nearly two decades. So I think for the Russians, I think yes, there was great celebration, as we know, in 2016 when he came to the presidency. I think the Russians have been watching with delight sort of how he kind of epitomizes corruption, essentially, of the US political system. We see all these democratic institutions which have been built over time to stand for certain principles, in particular your State Department being eroded through certain practices that Trump has been conducting, including the calling back of the ambassador to Ukraine because she was standing in the way of his own political operations. So I think the Russians have been cheering as Trump will kind of start appointing his men in charge of institutions like Voice of America and tearing down these principles that have made America a democratic ideal for many countries for a long time. So, you know, I think what is happening in the US, as you mentioned, in many ways parallels what has gone on in Putin's Russia at the beginning of his presidency, as Trump is beginning now to sort of use his populism, probably in a much more extreme way than Putin ever did at the beginning, to kind of try to kind of undermine institutions and sort of have his picks as judges and so on, to begin to erode the institutions which have made America such a great bastion of liberal democracy.
That was incredibly well said. I mean, yeah, Jim, I know Jim's mind is exploding over there on Zoom. I think we're getting short on time, and Jim usually asks kind of a big, broad last question, but Jim, do you mind if I do that today? And it's not necessarily deep or insightful, but one of the things I was wondering, even as I was reading your book, on a more personal level, as someone who is an investigative journalist working on Russia, on Putin's Russia, do you ever feel unsafe? Countless number of incidents inside Russia where people are doing investigative journalism who are looking into some of these corrupt networks that, you know, seems to be the favorite way is being pushed out of windows, but countless other ways that these security men are able to go after people who are vocal critics, who are speaking out against the regime and who are shining light on their corrupt practices. You know, where does your headspace as you're working on these things? How do you feel and do you feel unsafe?
No, I'm sitting in London. I'm not in Moscow anymore. I left Moscow actually while I was working on the book, but it was quite some time ago now, at the height of the standoff over Ukraine, just because it became more difficult to speak to my sources because the standoff with the West was escalating. They were less comfortable with meeting me in Moscow, but then many of them were coming to London where they were actually able to talk more freely. So it just became sort of easier to be here when I was able to still have the same, more or less the same access as I'd had before. In fact, it was better because people weren't so worried about looking over their shoulder. But I think, I'm a Western journalist. I'm not Russian. And I think that we've seen very much that it's the Russian journalists that are attacked, or it's the sort of the Russians who are seen as having betrayed their own people. That's the kind of the ultimate sin, and that's what makes you open for attack. I mean, I'm certainly not in the center of things. I'm very lucky. I'm sitting here in London, and I think probably in the time that I've spent writing this book, which indeed was a very long time, I did work on it for, in fact, 7 years. Russia has changed a great deal from even when I was a correspondent for the FT in Moscow. That was mostly during the Medvedev era, when Russia really did care about its image. And now we've seen all these steps since the annexation of Crimea, in which Russia has taken sort of more and more egregious and open actions, in which it really doesn't care anymore, in particular what the West thinks of it, because already we've seen these countermeasures such as sanctions, and in which the US government has openly pointed to some of Putin's closest cronies as the holder of funds for the Russian president, which of course also gave me a certain degree of security in writing about some of these close allies as kind of operating to manage funds for Putin or for his regime. So I think kind of in a way, the kind of the veil has been lifted, sort of the pretense that Putin and his security men may have had in the past to kind of, at least to paying lip service to kind of Western standards of behavior, has long disappeared. So I don't think they particularly care about anything I may have written in my book, though there have always been threats on the way, but not sort of ones where I felt unsafe.
Well, we sure feel grateful for all of the work that you put into the book. Again, if people have listened, I really can't endorse more. I mean, it's just a brilliant accounting of Putin's Russia. It provides so much insight into the nature of this regime. And even though it's, you know, there's parts of it that are historical, looking at that history and the nuance that you bring, I mean, you shed some light on new aspects and saw and interpreted things and made connections in a way I think that's different than the way that some people have understand the history. And I mean, what a contribution to the way that we think about Russia. So again, I just can't speak highly enough of the book. I hope that people will check it out because it just helps people understand, I think, exactly what we said at the beginning, how we got to where we are and even where things are likely to go.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to add my just thanks to what Andrea said. I think your book and what you laid out about Trump, it's not like that was new. It's not like we sat here and thought Trump was a Jeffersonian Democrat, if you will. But I think the way you laid it out, I don't think it's been laid out quite to that detail in the U.S. media. There might be somewhere here or there, but what you provided is so credible and so interesting that I hope people read your book. I mean, you know, the Steele dossier, you know, was this, you know, there were elements there, but it shifted to the background and was discredited. And, but what you have laid out, frankly, I think is the first real, substantive, credible, well-researched story of what happened at the end of the Soviet Union all the way up to Donald Trump. And that story, I don't think, has been laid out quite that way that I've seen. And so I do hope people read that book, and we'll certainly use Brussels sprouts to spread the word.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been really great talking to both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Catherine. You.